Hello, everyone, and welcome to Managed Healthcare Executives' monthly What's on Your Mind podcast. In this podcast series, editors will check in with members of the Managed Healthcare Executive Editorial Advisory Board and ask them what's on their mind. Some of these topics will include the challenges they and their organizations are facing, the uphill battles, and the success stories, the short horizon, and the longer game. We're going to pick their brains to give our listeners valuable information and insight into healthcare today. Hello, listeners. I'm Brianna Contreras, an editor with Managed Healthcare Executive. And in this episode, myself and Peter Werwein, managing editor of MHE, got to chatting with our newest editorial advisory board member, Jeffrey Kasberg. Jeffrey Kasberg is the Vice President of Clinical Pharmacy at IPD Analytics. And in our discussion, he shared the most pressing or prominent issues on his mind. He explained what the drug life cycle is at IPD and what the latest is on drugs in the pipeline. Kasberg also shared his predictions for Sarepta Therapeutics' DMD drug for young children and Mounjaro's type 2 diabetes drug, and even touched on some common misconceptions he notices about drug approvals, pricing, and cost.
Yeah, so again, thank you, Jeffrey, for this, for meeting with us today. Again, to start, so with this podcast being, you know, about what's on your mind in healthcare, if you could just share, you know, maybe what is on your mind these days, maybe some of the sticky problems and issues, the ones that are the most pressing or interesting, maybe in your career, your job, or in the industry.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for having me. So I have a couple things here to review for sticky topics today. First will be, I guess I would say, most recently, legislation. The Inflation Reduction Act, payer and pharma subscribers are very interested in the impacts, price negotiation, Part D redesign, inflation rebates. So the IRA, there's another one called ARPA, the ARPA, which is the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, which kind of removes some Medicaid rebate caps, and that could impact some drugs, especially in Medicaid. So getting quite a bit of interest in that as well in legislation. And then the PBM reforms, everybody's talked about PBM reforms and transparency and generic legislation. So legislation's kind of hot at the moment. It's another sticky area would be drug trend increases, kind of especially in that type 2 diabetes, the GLP-1 category, with also the drugs that everybody's talking about, Ozempic and Mounjaro. So a lot to talk about drug trend increases there. Hey, and biosimilars, of course, with the pending launch of a whole lot of Humira biosimilars around July 1st. So that's just around the corner. And then the Rx benefits and how the payers will react to that. And then lastly, gene therapies. Reimbursement and coverage. So that's three or four different kind of sticky hot topics.
Jeff, could I ask you to just unpack a little bit what the removal of the Medicaid recap means? Several people have mentioned that to me as being kind of the underlying reason for the decision by Novo Nordisk and Lilly and Sanofi to cut insulin prices, but I haven't got my head around it fully.
I'll do my best, and I may not explain it exactly right, but in general, there's been this rebate cap. I think it's AMP, a rebate cap of 100% of AMP, and I think that's correct. And then this ARPA 2021 Act removes that, coming up for 2024, removes the 100% cap. So the impact, to my knowledge, is that for certain drugs, manufacturers may have to pay Medicaid to dispense it, if you can believe that. So instead of the manufacturer getting revenue, the ultimate impact of the legislation could be that for certain drugs, the manufacturer may owe more than they get back.
Well, couldn't they just to say, no, Medicaid, we're not going to pay to have you use our drugs? I mean, nobody's forcing them to sell to Medicaid, right?
I believe you're right, but I think there's a lot of politics behind this that I don't know. So we're getting some questions on this.
Interesting. Well, maybe it's something that MHE needs to explore in depth because it keeps on coming up and I'm still puzzled by it. So let's talk about you a little bit. Because you're new to the editorial advisory board and this audience, I guess in kind of elevator, a pitch fashion, could you give us a short course on your career path and how you ended up at IPD Analytics?
Sure. I live in Connecticut. I'm a UConn grad, go Huskies. And went to UConn School of Pharmacy and, kind of did some traditional roles early on in my career. Retail, actually did a little pharmaceutical industry sales, home infusion. And then I went back and got a master's in healthcare management. I'm trying to figure out what to do with my career. And I hear about this something called managed care. And this was in kind of like the early 90s. So I started looking into it. I found a job in the newspaper with a company called WellPoint Pharmacy Management, which ended up turning into Anthem Pharmacy Management. So I got into managed care through that avenue. And then from there, I went on to be the pharmacy director at a health plan in Connecticut called Connecticare for 16 years. So I was there for a long time. And this was about 8 years ago. I was coming up on a kind of bigger birthday. And I decided, where am I going to go in my life? Am I going to stay here and ride it out? Or am I going to try something new? And I started to keep my ears open. And I came upon this company called IPD Analytics. And the owner called and we discussed the company. And it was really made up of intellectual property attorneys that track drug patents, and they would write patent analysis for Wall Street clients and analyze how long a drug would be available to be protected in, and then generics, and then how many generics would come. And they got a lot of questions on that stuff that the patent attorneys weren't good at talking medicine and drug management. So they wanted to bring on a pharmacist about 8 years ago. And so I joined them as their first pharmacist. And now we probably have 25 or 30 pharmacists. So from 2014 through now, IPD has grown quite a bit in drug management. And that's how I got involved with IPD.
And the company's tagline is the industry leader in drug lifestyle insights. So I have a lifestyle. I didn't know that drugs had a lifestyle. So what is, is that just a sales line, or is there some special meaning behind drug lifestyle, life cycle here?
Life cycle.
Yeah. Oh, life cycle, not lifestyle. Excuse me.
We could go either way. Life cycle insights. So what we do is we take drugs from early in development, phase one, phase two, and we follow them through their life cycle, all the way through loss of exclusivity and into generic competition. So we take them from infancy, way past adulthood, and we follow a drug from beginning to end and supply not only the patent analysis to understand patent protection and generic and biosimilar availability, but also how do you manage the drug? What are the rebates? What are the, formulary coverages, criteria, patient financial assistance programs, things like that.
So and who are the clients?
Our clients are pretty much anybody who's involved in pharmaceuticals. So we have most of the PBMs in the country, health plans, pharmaceutical manufacturers, brand and generic, specialty manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, hospital systems. All these people want to understand drug life cycles, and also like to read our management intelligence, management strategy intelligence.
You have to have firewalls, because I would think that the sort of analytics that you would deliver to the PBM might, you know, there might be some information that pharma wouldn't want you to share and vice versa. So how do you manage the fact that you, that apparently you have clients, you know, that are, can be adversaries?
I have a couple hats here. And then depending on who I'm speaking to, I put on a different hat. So when I'm speaking to the payers, you're looking from the angle of, you know, drug management, appropriate drug utilization, spending the healthcare dollar most efficiently, prior auth criteria, steps, quantity limits. When we're talking to the payers, I put on a different hat. And from their angle, they're looking at market access. So what can we tell them to help them approach payers and hospitals to and physicians to better sell their drug? What can we help them? How do we help them formulate their story to best access formularies?
Right.
With the drug pipeline, if you can maybe share any surprises lately, as far as drugs that have been approved, or maybe those that have been turned down.
Sure. You know, I guess one thing that when I listening to your question is, there's been a, I would say, a significant increase in something called CRLs, complete response letters. Mm-hmm. So as a drug has a PDUFA date and it's coming up to the PDUFA date, the FDA is looking at all different things. And what we found recently is the trend is it's not usually clinical concerns. I guess there are some at times, but it's usually a lot of these CRLs are due to manufacturing facility delays. So a lot of the drugs are manufactured overseas. The FDA goes visit the manufacturing facilities and they find a deficiency, and it sometimes takes months, a year to resolve these deficiencies. So I think one thing that we've seen in the pipeline recently is some delays in approval due to complete response letters, but from the FDA.
Jeff, is there any particular, can you give me an example just off the top of your head of a CRL that had to do with a manufacturing concern and not with the clinical trial data?
Sure. One that comes to mind is bimekizumab from UCB. It's a competitor to in the psoriasis space. It's an interleukin, would compete with Cosentyx and Stelara and Skyrizi, et cetera. And they've been delayed. I don't know. I'm going to guess it's been over a year.
Interesting. Interesting. And this pattern of CRLs having to do with manufacturing, do you think this has to do with overseas manufacturing, or is it because these are biologic drugs and fundamentally the biologic manufacturing process is, I believe, you know, technically more difficult?
I guess I'm going to say I don't know. A lot of times they don't tell you the exact detail of the problem. They'll say manufacturing, but they won't say exactly what it was. So I guess I can't answer that. And I, you know what, I've also haven't looked to see if it's more CRLs on biologics or traditional pharmaceuticals. But in general, we've seen a trend of CRLs in the last, say, 24 months or so.
Interesting. Interesting.
Any other surprises, things in the pipeline? I know, you know, recently we've had an OTC conversion of naloxone, Narcan, for opioid overdose from RX to OTC. I guess nothing surprises me, but I guess that was a pleasant thing. I hope that's positive for the community in general.
Mm-hmm.
See, any other surprises? you know, this whole, it's controversial. I try not to get too controversial here, but this whole medication abortion thing with, you know, people pushing back about potentially mifepristone and inappropriate approval back whenever it was approved. I just hope that it resolves itself and, you know, patients can get medically appropriate therapy. But, you know, I'm not a fan of politics getting involved in medicine either.
I was interested in the advisory vote on the Sarepta gene therapy for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. As you know, it was a close vote, 8-6. And as I read the media reports about it, I didn't have a chance to listen to the advisory committee meeting myself. It seemed that the closeness of the vote had to do with this familiar issue of surrogate endpoints and accelerated approval that, you know, was sort of became, I guess, kind of infamous as far when it came to the Aduhelm, the Alzheimer's drug. So what do you think? Do you think the FDA is going to approve this muscular dystrophy drug? Do you think they're going to add some requirements, enrollment in a registry or something to sort of, in some sense, hedge the bet? Or where do you see that headed?
If I went from medication abortion to, you know, Duchenne's and a controversial topic.
Well, that's where the interesting stuff is.
That's right. That's why you're here. You're here to ask the tough questions. So first, DMD, you know, it's a tough disease to say muscle weakness in young boys, you know, and everybody wants to treat children appropriately as much as possible. And I guess even back to the other DMD therapies that have been approved to date, it's been controversial. Do they work? Do they not? Around this surrogate endpoint of these dystrophin levels in the body, and does the dystrophin level equate to improved outcomes? As you can tell, we're debating it today, several years after the initial product was approved, and still really no clear answers. The FDA advisory committee voted close 8-6 for approval, but you know there was quite a bit of controversy there. Interestingly enough, this is a gene therapy, would be the first gene therapy. In the other drugs, the drugs were specific to a certain group of DMD patients with a certain mutation. This drug is a little different, that it treats a broader scope of patients, maybe up to 50% of the DMD patients. So maybe even a bigger decision than the approval of the other ones. I'll roll the dice. I'll say it's going to get approved. I think politics does involve. I mentioned I don't like politics and medicine, but I think the pressure is to approve. So I'll roll the dice that it's going to be approved.
I believe that one of the elements of the controversy about the dystrophin, Duchenne muscular dystrophy drugs is that the patient groups have been pushing very hard for approval. And, you know, it's a heart-wrenching situation because you have very, very sick children, mainly boys. And yet there seems to be some science that suggests that maybe the surrogate endpoint and the clinical outcome don't match up so well together.
Right.
So it's
a tough one. You know, then the FDA's had its lumps recently with approvals and things that were controversial. So the FDA is under more scrutiny now too. So it's a tough one for them as well.
If you had to pick the most important approvals for the first part of this year, the ones that you either will be most disruptive to payers in terms of their costs or just the clinical advances, time traveled 3 years ahead, what do you think is going to stand out you know, maybe the one or two drugs that were approved that are going to be marketed that are really going to make a difference?
So in the first half here, I guess you can't not say Leqembi and Alzheimer's from Eisai Biogen. So you have to mention that one. And then the one coming just after it, donanemab from Eli Lilly. So without a doubt, Alzheimer's approvals will impact the pharmaceutical industry in the future. So we have to say that one. There's a drug called Syfovre from Apellis Pharmaceuticals for geographic atrophy, which is part of dry AMD for the eye, ophthalmic drug. And there's never been we have wet AMD, which is Eylea, but we've never had a dry AMD drug. I think that's going to be impactful. There's more of these patients out there than you think. The drug may not be a home run, but it's a step in the right direction. Of course, not inexpensive. Another one called VEOZAH. I think it's called Veoza. Fezolinetant from Astellas Pharmaceuticals. It's the first non-hormonal vasomotor symptom menopause drug. So estrogens have always been used for menopause. This drug from Astellas just approved will be the first non-hormonal treatment. You don't hear a lot about it, but I think it'll be impactful to a large group of patients in the country. And then it's not really a drug, it's a vaccine. There's a couple RSV vaccines that one was just approved by GSK. I think it's Arvexi. And then there's another one on the way from Pfizer. I think they can have some impact. It's always funny, like you never heard about RSV too much. You knew about it as a pharmacist and all of a sudden there's two drugs, but then it's on the news all the time. So there's something going on there.
Yeah, I think the menopause drug will be interesting because I think, you know, there's been the science on hormone replacement has gone back and forth a good bit, as you know. And I think there's been a large number of women that have been concerned about hormone replacement because of some breast cancer risks. So this might mean there would be an alternative that wouldn't have wouldn't carry that risk, I presume.
Exactly.
Okay. Weight loss. I mean,
I guess we haven't mentioned that yet. I don't know if we
briefly. I think, you know, we'll be talking about weight loss forever, right? And Lord knows there's been weight loss drugs and problems with them over the years. And of course, there's the diet industrial complex. Some hope that a diet with, you know, sprinkled with a little exercise will help us lose weight. But you discussed Mounjaro at the AMCP meeting this spring as perhaps being a huge drug in terms of sales. So could you just fill us in where things stand with Mounjaro and your expectations for that drug?
Sure. The one statement I said was Mounjaro could be the first $100 billion drug. We'll see. So just to put that in perspective, Humira is a $25 billion, maybe $30 billion drug. So if Humira is the largest drug of all time at an annual sales of 25 to 30, and Mounjaro would be 100, be a big drug. Weight loss is kind of like the holy grail of pharmaceuticals because, you know, if you control your weight, you solve a lot of problems. It's a huge market. I just spoke to a subscriber of IPD in the last few weeks, and the subscriber mentioned that this GLP-1 category, actually, Mounjaro is a combination. It's GLP-1, GIP, GLP-1, GLP, I forget how they say it. But anyways, we'll call it a GLP-1. And they had stated that therapeutic class, which includes Ozempic and Trulicity and Victoza, is up about 75% year over year in that one category. So you never, you don't, you usually don't see that, and especially in a fairly mature category. So payers are having to control drug spend or attempt to control drug spend in that category. You know, I don't know if it's like maybe even 25% of payers have some type of coverage for weight loss. So it's not a lot. And many of those coverages are more, I think, self-funded clients. So the coverage is fairly slim at the moment. And payers, yes, are looking to add more controls as they look at their per member per month costs rising at those rates that we just mentioned, looking to be more strict, adding, you know, strict diabetes diagnosis and, you know, history of use of another type 2 diabetes product on their profile for the last 3 to 6. So trying to ensure the patient has type 2 diabetes and is not just taking it for weight loss. So yeah, I think this is this will be a topic that keeps all of us discussing weight loss for years to come.
So just to be clear, is Mounjaro, it has not been approved yet, correct?
No, Mounjaro is approved for type 2, but it is not yet approved for weight loss, where Ozempic is approved for type 2 diabetes, and then the same drug renamed Wegovy is approved for weight loss. But that'll be coming, I think, the end of this year.
And will Mounjaro carry a different name as a weight loss drug like Ozempic and Wegovy, or is it going to be marketed under the same name for the weight loss indication?
Lilly has not stated that, but I would presume they would also come out with a different name because of that benefit concern by payers. If it was the same name, it would create more confusion. So I'm going to guess Eli Lilly will follow suit and change the name for weight loss.
And you see it as maybe a $100 billion drug, but aren't the payers gonna, you know, prior auth this to bits and add utilization review? So even though there's this large problem with weight loss, I just wonder whether people are gonna have access to the drug as to these two drugs, Wegovy and whatever Mounjaro will be called as a weight loss drug, whether they'll have access because it won't be on a formulary, or whether, and also whether the prior auths will be such that you just won't be able to get a affordable prescription.
I'm not great at predicting the future, but I think slowly the doors will open up and there will be some more coverage coming up. I think the political pressure again will lend itself to more coverage. Another avenue to get to the 100 billion is we've heard of a diagnosis called NASH or fatty liver disease. Both Ozempic and Mounjaro are also being studied in NASH. So you have type 2 diabetes for these drugs. You have weight loss. You have NASH. I think that each one of those is big therapeutic categories. You add them all three and it's a monster. So the monster is growing.
Interesting. Interesting. So a drug with three hats, you only wear two.
Right.
Aside from Mounjaro and its getting improved for its weight loss indication, what would be your expectations for the big approvals and market happenings in the second half of the year? You referenced already the Humira biosimilars, the second wave, if you will, starting in July. But what else do you see as headline making news?
Coming up on July 6th, that Alzheimer's Leqembi could get full approval, which would then potentially be followed by a CMS decision on the national coverage determination, which has limited its use. So that will be the fulcrum on, you know, will the doors bust wide open in Alzheimer's disease? So we'll be waiting for that. You mentioned the Humira biosimilars, Roctavian by BioMarin, hemophilia A factor 8 product. First gene therapy in hemophilia could be approved coming up, competing with the market leader Hemlibra, could be a $2 to $3 million therapy. Like most of the gene therapy is very expensive. And then back to that ophthalmic, I talked about the dry AMD, but Eylea is coming out with Eylea HD high dose. Instead of 4 milligrams, it's going to be 8. Extend the treatment interval so you don't have to get injections in your eyes so often. Trying to compete with a new drug called Vabysmo from Roche Genentech. So there's some big things coming in the second half.
Yeah, nobody likes injections in the eye. So I imagine spacing the treatment would be key for Eylea. What do you think is the most common misperception about drug approvals and pricing? What is the bad idea out there that you would want to disabuse people of?
So drug pricing, approval, all this. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about drug pricing. You know, we built this monster in the United States, this very complex system. And I think recently the insulin price reform, the IRA, I think they're also, excuse me, steps in the right direction. But I think to chip away at this U.S. drug monster is going to take time. And I just hope at the end, once something is done to reform the U.S. drug pricing system, that there's still manufacturer desire to create new and innovative therapies like they have in the past.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode of Managed Healthcare Executives' What's on Your Mind podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Podcasts, and follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.